This podcast contains information, theories, and speculation based on the A Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. It can and will spoil future episodes of the HBO television series Game of Thrones. This is your one and only spoiler warning. If you're looking for our non-spoiler podcast on Game of Thrones, please look at our feed archive for Sunday night and Tuesday afternoon releases, or visit baldmove.com for our entire catalog. Hello and welcome to the spoiler edition of the Game of Thrones podcast, brought to you by Bald Move. You can find all of our stuff on baldmove.com. This is for episode 507, entitled The Gift of HBO's Game of Thrones television series. I'm your host, Aaron, and we're talking spoilers this week. Don't have a lot of preamble. There was a Vanity Fair article that was quoting one of the fan sites that had some casting news that's leaked out of the casting calls for Game of Thrones Season 6. That's kind of interesting, but I'm going to save those for later on in the season, maybe for the season wrap-up or at least episode 5-10. I want to kind of see what your guys' thoughts are, because I'll post the actual article in the show notes if you want to get the information. But the big news is it looks like I am wrong about the Greyjoy's importance to the series, because one of the casting things looks like it is for Euron Greyjoy. So that's kind of tantalizing. But again, don't want to talk about that too much this week. Want to sort of get straight into the listeners' emails. So let's start with Nathan P. He sends me an image that I kind of got to describe. I'll put this image in the show notes if you want to check it out. But it is a close-up view of the camera panning over rows and rows of faces in the Faceless Men's headquarters. And two of the faces right next to each other have some inserts to something showing Catelyn Stark and also something showing Lyza Arryn. And they say that these faces that are on the wall are supposedly Catelyn and Lyssa. And he wonders if Catelyn Stoneheart theory has been officially debunked, or are people just grasping at straws? I don't know. First off, to my eyes, these aren't really great matches for the Tully girls. The one that's supposed to be Cat looks like she's quite a bit older. And the one supposed to be Lyssa kind of looks like a dude, but, you know, to have that could be said of Lyssa herself. So they're not super conclusive. They could be, I mean, even if they were, they could be just an Easter egg put in by production staff to fuck with us. Or it could be that they had life casts of Catelyn and Lyssa for some kind of makeup or special effects reason and just reuse them. Either way, it's hard for me to see how the Faceless Men having Lyssa and Kat's face would say one thing or another about Lady Stoneheart. I guess if they had their faces, then clearly, you know, you're going to have a faceless Stoneheart if you do have a Stoneheart, which would kind of be horrifying and cool. But yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be in the realm of interesting Easter egg, and that's it, even if this is proved to be true. I don't think it says one way or another about Lady Stoneheart.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Moving on to Mike C. So Mike's Thee thinks that there is a hint to John's fate in the next episode, buried as an Easter egg into the preview of episode 508. I swear, Eamon talking about egg so much this week has just got the Easter egg people on a hunt. And Mike's found something, he thinks. First, I'm going to play you John's death scene from Dance with Dragons.
He punched John in the belly. When he pulled his hand away, the dagger stayed where he had buried it. John fell to his knees. He found the dagger's hilt and wrenched it free. In the cold night air, the wound was smoking. "Ghost," he whispered. Pain washed over him. "Stick them with a pointy end." When the third dagger took him between the shoulder blades, he gave a grunt and fell face first into the snow. He never felt the fourth knife. Only the cold.
Now here are the final few seconds of the preview for episode 508, beginning with a wildling saying he isn't going to break bread with a crow.
"My ancestors would spit on me if I broke bread with a crow."
All right, so if you can hold both of those in your head, I'll let Mike explain. He says, "I can only describe this as the audible interpretation of Jon Snow's attack. We hear a mix of five sound effects and soundtrack beats in an interesting sequence as follows. A beat that sounds like a hammer striking steel, the sound of a sword being drawn, another of the same hammer strike beat, then a more muffled beat, followed by a sound of a cold rushing wind while the Game of Thrones title is shown, then fading to black. I submit that each of the first four noises represent a knife being plunged into Jon Snow. The fourth one is muffled because, according to Jon's POV, he never felt it. Then following the fourth stab, cold, or the sound of a cold wind blowing." Well, you've heard the evidence, so I'm going to let you guys decide for yourself. To me, I'm not convinced because this muffled beat is standard end of preview ominous sound, kind of like the boom. As is the howling winds. I know I've heard that in previews before when they're talking about kind of shocking things happening beyond the wall. As is the hammer strike. That's in a lot of the Game of Thrones previews. But on the other hand, I'm pretty sure Jon Snow is going to quote unquote die this season. So maybe it is a bit of foreshadowing. As I said, I'm playing it and you can decide. Nick R. "The High Sparrow has caught my eye in this season of the show as the biggest new game changer in the field of play. Jonathan Pryce has done a masterful job bringing the character to life and has more than held his own sharing the screen with heavyweight forces such as Cersei and Lady Tyrell, or the Queen of Thorns, Olenna Tyrell. But, and perhaps partially because of the way he has perfectly played every situation thus far, something is amiss. There's no way that a total unknown can step on the field and effectively change the game at King's Landing virtually overnight. So maybe Lady Olenna is right, and he does have a motivation, but instead of greed, it's something more sinister, revenge. Now, I know you've covered the High Sparrow equals Jojen's dad theory, but there's another possibility. The High Sparrow is in fact a former High Lord who has a Targaryen loyalist, or who is a Targaryen loyalist. Surviving the rebellion, he is disgraced and loses everything, including his lands and his title, perhaps even prominently losing a son during the rebellion. At this point, he has a few options. Take the black, become a sellsword across the narrow sea, or find religion. Maybe he genuinely shed his old life and became a simple septon. Fast forward 15 years, and the new ruling class has become crippled by greed and bloated with excess and vice. He leads a holy crusade to feed these high lords, the same humble pie he was subjected to. Humble pie with the secret ingredient of revenge. Cut to season 5, the High Sparrow reveals himself in a Bond villainy speech, which is certainly ironic. Varys appears and they high-five. Together they have created a power vacuum necessary for a Targaryen to take the throne. I don't know if there's a High Lord or House who has been teased who would fit this bill. Thoughts? Well, that's kind of the problem. Positing someone that is a High Lord and a Targaryen loyalist that would, as you say, fit the bill. I mean, you know, Martin's introduced John Connington pretty late in the game, so I'm not saying it's impossible. It's just that there isn't any evidence to support the theory as yet. If anyone is listening and can name some names, maybe this could go somewhere. But until then, it's kind of interesting speculation. I mean, the thing about Robert is he pardoned most of the guys that he went to war against and turned them into allies. So that kind of explains the lack of Targaryen loyalists in the realm. and also like the lack of a huge core of Targaryen loyalists at the Wall, because just Robert straight up forgave a lot of them, which a lot of people saw as a mistake, and a lot of people saw as really smart statecraft. So who's to say? A man got killed by a pig. Moving on to Patrick. What if Doran uses Jaime to help him put Myrcella on the Iron Throne? That way would set in motion Cersei's Valonqar prophecy, as he'll also refuse to come back to King's Landing to help her with the High Sparrow situation. So yeah, I've been kicking around an idea of Jaime defecting and becoming Myrcella's Lord Commander of the Queen's Guard in Dorne. I like that because it's a big fuck you to Cersei. It kind of mirrors his disillusionment with his family and his sister in particular in the book. The problem I have is that it's also a huge fuck you to Tommen, and honestly, the show just hasn't done the groundwork necessary to sell a betrayal of this magnitude yet. Show Jaime still loves his sister, is blissfully unaware of any unfaithfulness on her part. He hates his brother Tyrion. He loves his father Tywin. On the other hand, if this stuff with Lancel plays out the way we think it will, with his confessions, maybe he'll find out about her unfaithfulness and side with Dorne and Myrcella. I mean, can I see a scene where Doran gives him a raven message that says she's on trial for unfaithfulness and Lancel's confessed all, and it's all the King's Landing Inquirer's son can talk about, and will that equal shit tons of internal monologues of him talking about Lancel and or thinking about Lancel's and the Kettlebacks and even Moonboy, for all I know? I don't know. The 100th time I read Lancel, the Kettleblacks, and Moonboy, for all I know, I was kind of sick of it, but it did a very great point of showing us how consumed Jaime was by the idea of his sister, which is his one true love, lightly abandoning him, that by the time he got to the end of the book and he throws Cersei's plea for help into the fire, it made good character sense. I wonder how they're going to sell that turn for Jaime, or if he's going to have a completely different arc. I don't know. John R. says, "Hey, Aaron, it's John from House Conspiring. While recording the podcast Now Conspiring and talking about the episode, I came up with a mildly interesting theory about where the show is really going with Dorne. I've been also very dissatisfied with Dorne due to how strangely it's deviated from the books, even though I like the idea on paper of Jaime and Bronn teaming up. After watching this week's episode, however, I think I've figured out just where the hell, or what the hell, is being set up. When we see Tyene flirting with Bronn and sort of playing with his life in the jail cells, I'm reminded of the seduction between Arianne Martell and Aerys Okart. So this leads me to believe they're actually transplanting Bronn and Tyene as this odd couple. I think Ilaria may still try to carry her plan out somehow by escaping Sunspear with Myrcella, though perhaps not to crown her. And I also think Tyene will essentially seduce Bronn and convince him to help them, similar to how Ser Aerys was bamboozled. This, of course, means Arya could be the one who killed Bronn in battle, or they may mix it up and have Bronn and Jaime face off against each other. After all, Jaime would almost certainly side with keeping Myrcella away from the Sand Snakes in this version of the story. It would also be satisfying to see the reluctant alliance between Jaime and Bronn disrupted by the fact that Bronn is only looking out for himself. They've certainly set this up. This may seem like a stretch to some, but I think it's far more faithful to what plays out in the books than anything else they could try to do at this point. Plus, you don't even have to kill off Bronn like they did with Aerys. He could just as easily pull a Darkstar and ride off to escape justice." Okay, so all the same problems with this theory of Jaime somehow siding with some faction with Myrcella applies to what I said to the previous theory. And I'd also like to add that there is no way in Seven Hells that I'm buying that Jaime can defeat Bronn in single combat. Now, maybe they have Jaime and Aerys against Bronn. Sure, that would be entertaining. Also, I kind of think it's groan-worthy to think that Bronn would throw aside a fortune and position and lands from the Lannisters for any woman, no matter how personally beautiful he found her. That seems like a Bush League pussy whip kind of move, and that's not the Bronn that we know and love, right? In the main cast, a viewer speculated that this antidote is something you have to keep taking for it to retain its effectiveness, and fine, I'd absolutely buy Bronn betraying Jaime to save his skin, because that is the thing that Bronn values most highly, his own life. But that's about it. I don't think the Sand Snakes or even Prince Doran can outbid the Lannisters, even with their minds running dry. Maybe that'll be a plot point, that he can just be outbid. But, you know, he's not going to be outbid by the Sand Snakes. he might be outbid by Doran, and I just don't see how to make the particulars of this stuff work. Also, I'm not super invested in how accurately this thing can follow the plot in the books, because I think the plot in the books is kind of a mess too, and at best, it seems like a/B plot that's eventually going to be supplanted by Doran's plan C, which I hope is better than the kid, you know, crowning Myrcella or sending Quentin off to get burnt by Dragonfire and court Danny. I don't know. Doran's not that great in the books. Doran has a lot of promise in the books, but somehow they've made it even worse in the show so far. And, I'm not holding my breath to see it get any better in the short term. Tyler M. says, I'm probably not the first one to say this, but what if the whole scene with Bronn and the Sand Snakes is the Double D's take on Aerys Okart, Arion Martell, Darkstar story arc? Maybe Bronn will fall for the flashing Sand Snake and is persuaded to make an attempt on the life of Myrcella, combining Aerys and Darkstar from the books. Bronn could ultimately meet his demise at the hands of Jaime, on a surprise stab from behind or something, but not until after he strikes a blow to Myrcella, possibly even a fatal blow, causing Doran to have no choice but enter the war early and send Tristain to Meereen to court Dany. Maybe not, but I think the Bronn theory could be a high potential plot. God damn, is there something in the water this week? What's going on here? I like specific parts of this theory. I like that Myrcella might get murdered. Well, that sounds strange. I don't think the pink monstrosity, the Princess Peach outfit, warrants death. It's not a death sentence. But I'm saying it might be interesting for her to die, which did would allow Tristain to fill in for Quentin's shoes and sail east to court Danny, though. But the problems are kind of formidable. Why would Bronn betray Jaime? If it's for love, I think I'm going to literally puke on air, which might be a first for podcasting. So that's cool. I like Doran entering the war. But I think it's going to look weird to send Tristain over to Essos to court Danny when we know she's already engaged and will likely be married before he gets there. I get that's roughly what happens in the book, but I thought it was kind of dumb then. And Doran had put the plan into motion long before her marriage alliance to Hisdar. I mean, I always thought that Quentin gets over there and's like, hey, aunt, marry me. And she's all like, I'm already engaged to this guy. Wah, wah. Also, I don't know what Doran's plan B or plan C is going to be in the books. He hasn't even articulated a damn plan in the show, and we're going on 8 episodes into this thing. If this had happened 4 episodes ago, before Danny proposed marriage to Hisdar, then there would be some real suspense. I mean, he's en route. Danny proposes marriage to Hisdar. Oh no, what you gonna do? That's a problem with the plot in the books. At no level did I ever take Quentin seriously after Danny took Hisdar as a husband. If she's going to follow her heart, I think she would have chosen Daario.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6-page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Moving on to Alex M., what are your thoughts on a random late-in-the-season character installation? Quentin. Doran Martell introduces Quentin Martell to Jaime and Bronn to bring his sons across the narrow sea to Meereen and Daenerys, taking the place of Archibald Ronwood, Ironwood, and Garrus Drinkwater. I hope I'm pronouncing those correct, because I don't think I've ever heard, or I don't remember how Roy pronounced them in the read-along books. Anyway, I thought of this once when Jaime and Bronn were captured. However, I couldn't bring myself to act on the thoughts, just like Doran has all season long. Ooh, low blow on Doran. The man's confined to a wheelchair, for God's sakes. I like this theory the best. I still feel like sending Quentin or Tristane or whom over to Danny at this point is going to be kind of ridiculous, but I don't know. Maybe the Winds of Winter comes out and Doran's plan B is amazing and Quentin is a crucial piece of that puzzle and I'll owe George an apology and by extension the double D's. But I feel like at this point in the season, the double D's have really not capitalized on the potential to streamline plot and streamline characters. I mean, a lot of this stuff is feeling more like change for change's sake and not like change for character economy or plot economy. And, you know, I'm on board for the latter. The first, a change for change's sake, kind of strikes me as what's going on a lot at The Walking Dead. And it's almost never as good as the original material. And I don't know. I'm probably going to look like a jackass because we still have 3 episodes left and this could all, you know, be wrapped up tidy. And, you know, Doran is going to be good and Winterfell is going to be good and all that. But right now, I'm a little restless and I'm kind of amazed that they're doing this when the first 4 seasons were largely successful because they were faithful adaptations of the book series. I don't know. Let's continue with Christopher R. When Cersei sent Lord Tyrell to negotiate with the Iron Bank, she sent Meryn Trent to accompany him. With only a few episodes left, do you think we'll see a conclusion to that plotline? I'm intrigued by the idea that Arya will be in the same city as one of the names on her list, so maybe running to Meryn Trent would be reason enough for her to forget about the Faceless Men and go dig up Needle from under a rock on the beach. Yeah, I know we talked about this a couple weeks ago, but it's been a while since we've revisited this, and I know this podcast being... every season of Game of Thrones, the audience we start off with in episode 1, by the time we're in episode 10, we're roughly 50% higher, which is, again, you know, the difference between episode 1 and this episode 10 from last season is roughly 50% too. So at any given time, I'm dealing with half of an audience that has not heard anything but like the last 2 or 3 podcasts, which is interesting. But so that's why I kind of revisit some of these topics from time to time. But I think it's pretty obvious that Arya is going to be giving out the gift to Ser Meryn before the season is over. I think it's kind of going to go down like the books, where she's assigned a legitimate target or a legitimate activity to do some spying or some skulk work for the Faceless Men, which she will successfully accomplish, but she'll see Meryn Trant, walking around, and she won't be able to deny her Arya Stark lone wolf side justice, and then Jaqen's going to blind her. I would have figured that this would have happened a few episodes ago, and I'm really kind of shocked at how, you know, it feels like this show has been kind of dragging its feet in the mid-season. The last three episodes or so, there was such a head of steam built up and so much stuff being economized and downsized and kind of repackaged that it's like, well, maybe they will be able to set up a fairly breathless ride and get into the new books in the last two or three episodes. But it doesn't feel that way. It feels like structurally they still kind of want to end this season right at the end of Dance. And I don't know, maybe they're more afraid of overtaking George than I would have given them credit for. Maybe George saying, hey, I'm going to get the new books out before the next season has kind of given them motivation. Or maybe the other thing is it just would feel weird to deal with the climax of one book in like episode 7 and then end with the final three episodes being kind of, you know, the slow buildup of the next season. So maybe just from a narrative point, they're like, ah, there was no good answers, and this is what we end up getting stuck with. But I don't know. It's hard to put your finger right on. And I'm not saying this is a bad show, because still, it's a great television show that is right up there with the best of television. But I have to be honest, I am a little restless as a Game of Thrones fan watching this season. Kevin R. says, I believe it's a foregone conclusion that For the Watch will happen in episode 9. I'm interested to hear what you think the aftermath of Jon's betrayal will be. One theory suggests that Jon will be rescued by Ghost and or Melisandre if she returns to the Wall before the mutineers kill him, and in the finale will be revealed that Jon is in a coma state like Bran before him. However, an alternate theory I've seen floating around is that the mutineers do in fact kill Jon, and in the finale they burn his body on a funeral pyre, but Jon does not burn and rise from the ashes. This would reveal that Jon is a Targaryen and the show a link between himself and Dany. And then you can end the season there. So I personally dislike the idea of Jon just rising from the flames without the use of warging or Lord of Light magic, because that's not what Dany did. Dany went into the flames alive and she emerged unscathed. Also, we've seen Jon get the shit burnt out of him by a lantern in, I believe, season 1 when he fended off the White Walker attack from the Lord Commander, the Old Bear. So why introduce the mechanics of resurrection and or warging if you're not going to use them? And why show that Jon is not fireproof and then later you're going to show him to be fireproof? On the other hand, him arising from the flames would be one way to raise and at least in show watchers' minds a direct connection to him and Targaryens, which thus far the show has been really slow to develop. I mean, hell, the Littlefinger speech in the crypt about Lyanna and Rhaegar and Barristan's talk of Rhaegar is really the first real steps they've taken to build that. I mean, there's a little bit of hints in season 1 and season 2, but certainly the show's been much slower on building that than the Game of Thrones or the Song of Ice and Fire series is. So my thought is, I'd be disappointed if they went with either a coma or a fireborn resurrection. I think the coma would just come off like some kind of dumb cliffhanger, because people are like, they're not going to kill Jon Snow. Kind of like the way we do with Dance of Dragons, right? And that's a fair point to make about his fate in the books. So I don't know if that's weak, but it feels somehow weaker to me to do that on television. And I think the fire thing would feel pretty random and not very Game of Thrones. That's my opinion. I'd love to hear your guys's. Moving on to Andrew R., you mentioned, or perhaps it was a listener email, that many book readers are irritated with the nihilism in the story, and therefore parts, or perhaps they would not mind if Jon was not murdered, or almost murdered, or whatever, on the show. Count me among those. When I read the parts, I literally put the book down and said aloud, "Screw you, George R.R. Martin." It's a credit to the story that I care about so many of the characters, but are all the ones I like going to be killed? Perhaps this suggests I'm ultimately naive, or that I buy into simplistic and unrealistic good triumphs over evil crap, but I'd like some good to prevail. The bottom line is, I need some comeuppance, and if I don't get some in the next two books, I mean, I need at least to see the Boltons and the Freys get theirs, then I'm going to be left with a very bitter taste in my mouth. Well, from what I can tell of George Andrew, he seems like a really nice guy, and I doubt he'd tell the Song of Ice and Fire in a way that would just be pointless cruelty and misery. If it does end in a bitter fashion, then I would at least hope and expect it would be to make a larger point that would resonate with the reader. And that point can't just be war is bad, okay? I would not be surprised if all the characters we care about do die, but doing so in a way that will bring about a hope for the future, perhaps by permanently ending the threat of the others, or perhaps we'll find out, as we've talked about in a tinfoil segment from last season, that it's men who have broken some kind of ancient pact, and the others are out for revenge against us, and we'll broker some kind of renewed peace with them. It's not like George to make a one-dimensional pure race of evil beings, after all, right? The White Walkers have to have some kind of motivation, and that's going to be the key to the climax of the story, I believe, that unraveling what they want and why they are this belligerent force is going to give us a clarity about the finale of the series we just can't see right now. That's my thoughts anyway. Moving on to REG. I am more certain than ever that Sansa is being set up to replace Lady Stoneheart. Just look at her this episode. She's got the whole hood thing going, the hardened stare. She's swiping corkscrews and shit. Instead of an undead Catelyn Stark, we get a live Sansa Stark. A positive change from the books, as I was never too into Lady Stoneheart character. Sansa will send Brienne after the Kingslayer. I think that Jaime and Brienne will meet next season at the Siege of Riverrun, the ancestral seat of House Tully, where Catelyn grew up. I recently rewatched the scene from last season where Jaime sends Brienne on her mission to find Sansa, and I just got a feeling that everything will come back around. Well, they did make a big deal out of the Blackfish surviving the Red Wedding, and he, as of yet, is unaccounted for. Maybe they just have him swim downstream to Riverrun and fly to Stark Banner just for Jaime to go ride forth and resolve next season. That kind of sounds ridiculous, though. Bringing the Riverlands to the King's Peace was an interesting thing to have Jaime do in the books, but I feel like it would feel like the plot is moving backwards at this point in the show, because they invented something for Jaime to go do in Dorne to replace his storyline about pacifying the Riverlands, and then go bring it back around in season 6 to have him pacify the Riverlands. I don't know. I mean, it's getting increasingly hard for me to separate the experience as a show watcher and a book reader, because maybe a show watcher would be like, I don't give a shit because I didn't know the existence of either of these plot lines, so I don't know that they were supposed to happen at the same time, and it feels like treading water, but I can't help but, to my ear, having it feel like you're treading plot water, and I feel like we're doing a lot of treading plot water in this season, and I'm not looking forward to more of the same next season. I would like to get into some new stuff. I do think that Jaime and Brienne aren't done. I mean, that's not a controversial statement. And I'm on board with Sansa Stoneheart. I'm on board with her being alive. I think that she can quite conceivably and plausibly order Brienne to kill Jaime as a test of loyalty, which, by the way, is not a good sign for the Jaime plus Bronn plus Tristan going to Essos theory. I mean, Jaime can't cross the narrow sea with them and still be relevant and be able to reconnect with Brienne in dramatic fashion. I mean, eventually, some of these kind of tinfoily show theories are mutually exclusive, and I'm way more invested in Jaime and Brienne meeting some kind of satisfying end to their character arcs than I am Jaime and Bronn going over to Essos with another character that I don't care to probably ultimately have a doomed relationship with Dany. Matt from Knoxville says, so here's what I'm thinking the show may do with the Winterfell Wall Hardhome plotline. In order to fulfill her Lord of Light prophecy nonsense, Melisandre defies Stannis and with the help of Selyse tries to burn Shireen. Stannis is wroth with her, but the combination of impending battle and Melisandre's magical booty force Stannis to send her to the wall to be dealt with later, when normally Stannis would have shortened her by a head. So Melisandre arrives at the wall just as Jon is returning from Hardhome. Hopefully Jon is returning after a kick-ass battle with White Walkers. The Watch murders Jon. Etu, you fuck. Then Melisandre is there to give him the kiss of life, but then she dies in the scene similarly to how Beric Dondarrion passes his last fire to Lady Stoneheart in a book. I don't think the ghost will be involved. But the show has to have Drogon landing on the fighting pits to carry away Dany, right? I think we'll get cheated out of the Battle of Winterfell, though, which is a shame. Yeah, I don't think they can get away with disappointing us by not having the climax be Drogon and Dany. And also, if this process doesn't involve ghosts somehow, why throw in the gratuitous scene of Ghost saving Sam and Gilly, which doesn't happen in the books. I feel like that is a reminder that, hey, Ghost is still a real thing, and he's got a connection there with John. But, you know, about the Drogon and Dany thing, I don't think they can kick that to next season, because think about it, just from a narrative standpoint, that moment would be so weird to just open the season with. It makes a lot more sense to open next season with Dany in old Valyria, or she's in the Dothraki Sea, just chilling with Drogon, and they're trying to figure each other out. As far as Winterfell, I feel like they'll punt that the next season, or just allude to it like they do in the books, and what actually happens will be revealed next year, because it does seem like they're very unwilling to tread much beyond what happens in Dance this year. I don't know if it's out of respect for George, or again, because it just doesn't fit a satisfying dramatic arc, but it does feel like that's what they're doing. He continues, and then we get a flash of a pair of cold hands wrapped around a stone heart before a fade to black. All right. Simmer down. You're just setting yourself up for disappointment and tears. I mean, we all did this last year, Matt. If we see a Lady Stoneheart that's not a Sansa Stoneheart, all well and good, but I am not going to set my expectations for that this year. Patience B says, you guys joke about Targaryens supposedly being fireproof, but isn't it only special rare Targaryens? The Dragon Riders? Isn't that why Viserys, her brother, was killed by the Gold and she said that he was no dragon? Am I making sense? They have given us many scenes showing that Dany can't be burnt, but no one else. So, I don't know how else I can explain this. Fireproof Targaryens are kind of sort of a thing in the show. And Martin says they're absolutely not a thing in the books. That Dany's fire resistance, quote-unquote, and the funeral pyre was a one-time blood magic ritual thing. So how do you reconcile these two concepts? I mean, even in the show, it could be argued that it's just confined to Dany because her brother is a full-blooded Targaryen and he dies. There's a lot of stuff in the books that says Targaryens are resistant to fire, and to disease, and that their dicks are all 3 feet long, and their tits are all triple G cup, and that's a lot of things that Targaryens love to say about themselves. But also, in the books, there's a lot of Targaryens trying to gargle wildfire and bursting into flames, and a lot of Targaryens dying of the plague, and I've yet to see one trip on their cocks, so I'm thinking, from a book perspective, they're kind of full of shit. They're arrogant, and they're elitist, and they conquered the whole continent of Westeros, so they think they're the biggest and baddest people on the planet, and that gives them license to weave all this myths about themselves. From a show perspective, I don't know. I don't think it's a general Targaryen trait, because as you've said, Viserys, well, sure, wasn't fireproof, and nobody's ever disputed that he's a real full-blooded Targaryen. We all suspect Jon's a Targaryen, right? And he burnt his hand on a lantern. And a lot of people suspect that Jon's going to be a Dragon Rider, so you can't even say, well, it's only the true Dragon Rider kind of thing. I don't know. I think I kind of trust in George Martin, what he says about that being a one-time deal, but there's not enough evidence to say either way on the TV show, because you could also say that this fire resistance was just a way to explain kind of subtle things about what's going to happen to Dany without having to talk about a whole bunch of blood magic and ritual and all that kind of stuff. You know, it works on multiple levels and multiple levels of viewers' observational skills and interest in the material. So again, jury's still out on all those theories.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
¶¶
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Trey C. mentions, you talk a lot about how there might not be an Iron Throne by the end of things, but a more representative government. At first, I didn't think this is likely, but after reading The World of Ice and Fire, I now somewhat agree with you. While I do not think we'll see a Westerosi democracy, I do think we will maybe see a return to the government model in line with the Valyrian freehold. Dany's focus on freedom is in line with traditional Valyrian values. So, with Tyrion on her side, we may see her embracing her ancient cultural heritage once more. Just a thought. All right, so here's what the Wiki of Ice and Fire has to say about the Valyrian Freehold. The Freehold of Valyria, at the zenith of its power, was neither a kingdom nor an empire, or at least it had neither a king nor an emperor. Instead, all freeholders, or freeborn landowners, had a say in its governance. In practice, however, the Freehold was ruled by the Lord's Freeholder, powerful noble families. There were 40 families of great wealth, high birth, and strong sorceress ability. Those families which controlled and rode dragons in battle, who came to dominate, were known as dragon lords. So, this to me sounds like a mashup of straight-up feudalism and the Roman Republic right around the time of its collapse, which was corrupt as all hell. And the Freehold employed widespread slavery, which is anathema to Dany. I'm not sure if I'd be happy with Dany or whomever setting up a system where the landed gentry have a say in the government. It still seems like a very top-down, screw-the-little-guy kind of deal. But I'm also probably being naive asking for a Westerosi-style parliamentary form of government. They continue, one last super tinfoil thought. As anyone considered grayscale may not have been intended for people who were, and we are just its vectors? If it's Garen's curse, it could stand to reason the real target was Valyrian dragons. What's interesting, but I'm struggling to think of one example of a dragon coming down with grayscale, and grayscale has, of course, been seen in Westeros. So, you know, if I put on my science hat, I think that a dragon's physiology seems completely alien to humans. They have freaky-deaky magma ooze for blood, after all. It's hard to believe that a virus that infects humans could also infect a dragon and vice versa. There's also a theory running around that the maesters had something to do with the demise of the dragon. So maybe it was an engineered plague of sorts. And again, this is a Song of Ice and Fire. It has its own rules as far as genetics, where black hair always beats blonde hair. And a lot of it's got magic, and it's got season winters that can last anywhere from a few years to generations. So your science hat doesn't tell you a lot in this world. But I just see very little evidence that grayscale is a dragon plague in the books or the series. Isaac R. says, given the Double D's decision to fast forward the Tyrion and Jorah's unification with Daenerys, do you think Martin has given them plot points for them to work with, or will they simply stall so as not to mess things up? I could definitely see Daenerys just throwing them in the dungeon until she makes up her mind about what to do with them. Maybe Jorah will be fighting Dario in the pits, and Tyrion will be watching them from afar when Drogon swoops in to take Daenerys for a little joyride. I predict that Tyrion's only contribution to the show's plot for this season will be a shot of his jaw dropping at the sight of Drogon's dramatic entrance and exit. Which, by the way, do you think will be the finale of the season? Okay, the Double D's, Dan and David, have said that they've met with George, and they understand where the show is going and the broad strokes of how they'll get there, and George has confirmed that as well. George has also said that he's determined to get the Winds of Winter out before next spring's finale, so we'll see. Having said that, I wouldn't be surprised if 75 to 80% of the Winds of Winter is already done. I mean, there's already like 10 to 20% of the final book that's out in the form of preview chapters, things he's read at conventions, and other stuff. It's kind of similar to where we were at with Dance before it was released, where we had 15 chapters out of 60-some that were already released. So I don't think they're really flying all that blind when it comes to this season. I fully expect them to have all of these manuscripts that they can read and glean plot details from, and then a lot of kind of bullet points about, like, this is how we get from this scene to that scene, and then a comprehensive, probably, treatment of how the last book goes and where everything's eventually going. So I don't think they're flying all that blind when it comes to this season. I think they're actually going to be pretty fine next season. It's the season after that, the finale of the series, if that's what we end up getting, a 7-season finale rather than an 8-season show. It's the season after that that I'm most worried about, because it's likely that Martin will have just begun writing. And, you know, all bets are off. If George at the end thinks he's got a better idea than what eventually happened on the show, I think he'll use it. I don't think he'll feel like he's got to be a slave to how he thought it was going to originally go down. However, having saying that, he's surely got to have some kind of brilliant idea for all this to be finished that he's working towards. And why would he so casually dismiss something he's been working on for 20 plus years? I don't know. This is the key kind of like dilemma that we are in as fans of the book and the television show. You know, we're faced a reality where the final two seasons might be really different, and, you know, best case scenario is they're different enough to be enjoyable and to ask different questions and to get different things out, but they ultimately kind of resolve the same way and they both feel satisfying. Worst case, the show is going to spoil enough in the book to kind of rob it of any value and ultimately be unsatisfying because it doesn't tell the story as well, or perhaps the story just doesn't end as well. And it's kind of going to be a bummer. We'll have to find out. I do think that if I have to make a prediction, I think that John's eyes kind of fluttering open or snapping open, or Danny riding off into the skies on Drogon, will be the last thing we see this season. And my money would be on her riding off into the skies on Drogon. That would be just a cool, cool, epic image to end the season on. He continues, Isaac continues, this season probably won't do anything to answer this question, but what do you think the ramifications of Tyrion being in Meereen during Daenerys' absence might be? Could he do some sneaking around and figure out who Hisdar is up to? Might Tyrion and Jorah team up to kick his butt? So this is a great, great point of speculation. One of the frustrations with the books is that Barristan is way over his head when dealing with the post-Drogon political intrigue in Meereen, which has always been kind of annoying to me. I mean, all he can do is really swing a sword, which he does well. His heart's in the right place, you know. But do you know who can deal with political intrigue and do it well? Fucking Tyrion Lannister. Do you know who can swing a sword? Fucking Jorah Mormont. I actually think that they together can be more interesting and just as badass as old Selmy, which, you know, pains me to say. In fact, I'm actually feeling a bit like an asshole because I feel like we might very well get to see Jorah in that Kraz scene that I played after Barristan died for all the show watchers, and I bet I get a lot of pissy emails from show watchers emailing me about how I spoiled it. And potentially I have that to look forward to, and I'll probably deserve it, because I thought in the back of my mind, man, what if they remix this and they do it? And I'm like, this is such an iconic Selmy scene. There's no way they can do it. And I love Selmy so much, and I love that scene so much that I had to get it in there. And if they give that to Jorah, I'm going to feel like a real asshole. So we'll see. We'll see. Luke B says, I think the end will mirror the books with Varys killing the current Hand of the King. I wonder, though, if it will be Kevin. I think it would be way more impactful to have it be Littlefinger that meets his death. Show Kevin has been both recast and not really shown much. His death in the show would not mean as much. I don't know that he's been recast. I tried to look this up on IMDb, and then I got distracted in some other thing, and then I forgot until I'm recording this right now, so shit. But I thought it was the same character that we saw in at least season 2, and I don't think he was in there before season 2. They continue, with Sans and Littlefinger's plot seemingly remixed, I wonder if Littlefinger will step in to try to take Cersei's place at Tommen's side. This would fit his character as he's been slowly trying to gain more power, and with the Vale and potentially Winterfell behind him, he's basically Tywin 2.0, as if he were made to be Tommen's hand. Well, I mean, obviously, you can't have it both ways. And if I was guessing, I'd rather see Littlefinger die by Varys's hand. I mean, I always liked Varys better than Littlefinger. So that would be pretty cool, personally. On the other hand, why reestablish Kevin as a character at all this season? We didn't need to see him introduce us to Lancel. I mean, we last saw Kevin in season 2, same as Lancel, and we saw way more of Lancel. Also, Littlefinger still has a role to play with Sansa, and I'm not sure what, but I feel like she's going to be a key to his downfall. I think after this season, she'll have the motivation to try to bring him down, and that he'll have this giant Sansa-sized blind spot that he won't be keeping his eye on. I mean, I don't know. I say that and it kind of sounds stupid. It's hard to imagine anyone bringing Littlefinger down. It'll probably be something random like a street rat throwing a rock to his head one day or something, the day his ladder of chaos finally runs out. But to the extent that I think Littlefinger is a key figure, which is probably the understatement of the century, a key figure in A Song of Ice and Fire, and he still has stuff to do, I doubt that they kill Littlefinger. And, you know, Martin's razor would suggest, why bring Kevin back at all other than for the show watchers to feel like, ah, we finally got, you know, a chip off the old Tywin block coming back to save King's Landing or put, you know, save the Lannisters, pull their fat out of the fire, and then herp derp, he gets a crossbow bolt in the chest. So I think that's probably more likely. Josh H. said on episode 5 spoiler cast, I floated the idea that maybe John makes it out unscathed. I was pleasantly surprised that at least one emailer the next cast wouldn't riot if that happens. Could it be Sam that gets to stabbing? He certainly didn't make any friends while John was away. I think it far too much has to happen for the watch scene to happen. Sam and Ed are still both at the wall. I don't see them participating, and Ghost didn't seem to be caged up for that matter either. So if Sam gets stabbed at the wall, first of all, Ed rode up north with John. But if Sam gets stabbed at the wall, then I will be dismayed. I don't know if I'll riot, but I'm really interested in what Sirella and Jaqen are doing infiltrating the Citadel. And Sam's a key component of that plot. If Sam dies, then I don't see how they get around to that plot, which means there's this huge sequence of clandestine, mysterious events going on at the Citadel that's probably just going to be irrelevant. And I don't know. I mean, that was what the prologue and epilogue with Dance of Dragons is all about. So that screams that it's important. So you got to have Sam or somebody go to the Citadel. And if not Sam, who? According to IMDb, Josh continues, which I know is not super reliable, but as I get closer, it may be right. Episode 10 is called Winter. And the dude that played Night's King is supposedly cast, as well as the actor who played Benjen. If both these are true, how do you think that would affect the storyline at the wall? Holy shit. All right, so here's the thing about IMDb. I just checked, and it now says, at the time of me recording this, that it's back to TBD, to be determined. Earlier this morning, according to Reddit, the episode was entitled Mother's Mercy. I mean, this is all total bullshit, just like I said last week. So I think it's still too early to draw conclusions. Maybe next week we'll get something legit and something final, because after all, they eventually have to get all this stuff ready for the TV guides and the program directories and whatnot. That said, it wouldn't surprise me to see the White Walkers and the Night's King before the end of the season. I will say this, if Benjen Stark shows up in episode 10, I will take red lipstick and I will write the word dick on my forehead for the live video version of our main podcast. That's how confident I am that he is not going to show up. If Benjen Stark shows back up, I don't know what that does to r/Game of Thrones and r/A Song of Ice and Fire. Like, it's one of the biggest recurring jokes that he's going to be relevant 5 books after he's introduced. He's nowhere to be found in Dance of Dragons. Again, I feel very confident. I was almost so confident that I said that I was going to eat this giant emperor scorpion that's freeze-dried and sitting on a shelf in a little case behind me. That's the only bug that Jim and I were both too big of a puss to eat on that one lunch with Jim and Aaron Friday thing that we do for supporters, where we ate all the different bugs. We got to that one and we both noped out. But I'm not that fucking confident. And I'm not even sure I'm confident enough to say I'll eat that thing if the sun doesn't rise tomorrow. Because just so you can calibrate your confidence scale of Aaron, that thing is terrifying. I'm kind of gagging just thinking about it. So I'm confident enough to wear the word dick on my forehead, not confident enough to eat a giant, scary-looking bug. So there you go. Speaking of me being a dick and wrong, let's talk about the tinfoil section. I have exactly 3 tinfoil theories left, and I'm not really that thrilled about either of them or any of them. One is really fun and funny, but kind of dumb. That's the one you're going to get this week. 2 are interesting, but fairly long and dry comparisons of A Song of Ice and Fire to Norse mythology and the Bible, respectively. I have a few others, but they're also super long and very hard to source quotes from, which is another thing. Like, I personally don't like just talking about theories that don't have concrete statements that back them up in the books. If it's just people making inferences from people's motivations and, you know, unconnected plots and patterns and literature and stuff, it's not as interesting, because I don't literally believe George Martin took chapters 12 through 18 from the book of Revelations and said, I'm going to match up verse for verse and I'm going to use that as a template to write the books. I just don't. So I know I've also gotten several feedbacks the last week from people to say they haven't enjoyed the last few tinfoil theories as much as the first 15 or 16 or whatever. And I agree with you. I mean, I said at the beginning of the season, we're really starting to scrape the bottom of the barrel as far as tinfoil goes. I don't know what to do about that. I'm kind of excited about next season because supposedly we'll have the Winds of Winter to go crazy on. But what if it's not out? Or what if it comes out the week before the series starts in season 6? I doubt there's going to be a lot of really good tinfoil theories or analysis for the first few weeks, as everyone's going to be reading and rereading the books. I mean, I don't know what to do long term. But for this week, I took an informal poll on the forums at forums.baldmove.com and I asked people, do you want to hear about casting news or kind of funny, kind of pointless tinfoil? And people said, we want the tinfoil. So tinfoil you shall have. I think we'll get to the casting news maybe the final week or the wrap-up week. But now, without further ado, I bring you The Merlin King, which was first brought to light by user Nightflyer all the way back in May of 2008 on the famed Forum of Ice and Fire. So this theory posits that Varys is not a human, but rather a mermaid, or in his case, a merman, or as they're called collectively as a species, Merlings. Merlings are well established in Westerosi lore. There's plenty of legends and myths involving them, especially among the seafaring people, such as Ironborn. The Merlin King is a god that is one of the many worshipped by the Faceless Men. Merlings are assumed to be mere mythological creatures by all the intelligent and educated people of Westeros, just like Krakens, Grumpkins, Snarks, Mammoths, Giants, White Walkers, and Children of the Forest. Entirely mythological beasts. But what if there are Merlings and they walk among us? Let me ask you, what do we know about Varys? He's bald, he's a eunuch, he's good with disguises, he has a smile frequently described as slimy, he's fat, but he moves with a fluidity and grace that belies his size, he habitually wears long flowing robes that obscure his lower half. If Varys is a Merling, this all makes a lot of sense. Of course his smile would be slimy. He's not a eunuch, it's just his Merling anatomy makes it seem like he is, and he encourages people's mistaken impression with some trumped up pulpy story about getting a stone and pillars cut off and cast into fires by a warlock. That also eliminates questions about his lack of human relationships. Of course Varys doesn't enjoy the company of men or women. He's a Merling, you sicko. He wants to fuck us just about as much as we want to fuck a carp. Varys' bulk could hide the fact that there is something very fishy about his lower half, and Merlings of myth are said to be possessed of superhuman strength and endurance, which would explain why he's light on his feet. And I say feet, of course, ironically. We've never seen his feet. The fact that he's good at disguises and wears flowing robes that would hide any unsightly scales or fins is just all gravy. Now, I can hear you say already, but Aaron, this is horseshit. You're just making stuff up. And I'd respond, I'm not making anything up. It's actually Nightflyer making shit up. I'm just repeating what he said. And also, our stocks of tinfoil are dwindling. And also, shut up. But there is a lot of evidence for you naysayers beyond just his mere appearance. Ask yourself, where does Varys sleep? The books tell us that he sleeps on a solid slab of granite.
Varys closed the door and barred it. I'm plagued with backaches, my lord, and prefer to sleep upon a hard surface. I would have taken you for a feather bed, man. I'm full of surprises.
Full of surprises indeed, Varys. In fact, we later find out that this bed is just a ruse.
When the candle burned out, Tyrion disentangled himself and lit another. Then he made a round of the walls, tapping on each in turn, searching for the hidden door. Shae sat with her legs drawn up and her arms wrapped around them, watching him. Finally she said, "They're under the bed, the secret steps." He looked at her, incredulous. "The bed? The bed is solid stone. It weighs half a ton. There's a place where Varys pushes, and it floats right up. I asked him how, and he said it was magic."
Magic my ass. Varys' Merling physiology makes conventional beds infeasible, so he converts his into a fancy trapdoor to a super-secret underground tunnel system throughout the Red Keep and King's Landing. Well, where does Varys sleep? You might be surprised that the book supplies with an answer. If you recall, in Game of Thrones, there's a POV chapter with Arya, where she's creeping around in the tunnels beneath King's Landing, and she overhears Varys and Illyrio plotting. Let me read you a snippet of this.
"The man with a torch pushed at something. Arya heard a deep rumbling. A huge slab of rock, red in the torchlight, slid down out of the ceiling with a resounding crash that almost made her cry out. Where the entry to the well had been was nothing but stone, solid and unbroken."
So Arya is hanging out in these dank tunnels with the sounds of dripping water everywhere, and Varys and Illyrio pop out of a well, huh? Well, that's super convenient. Arya later follows these tunnels to their exit, which is a sewer that terminates into a river that then flows out into the ocean. Seems like a pretty shitty place to get in and out of if you're a human, but if you're Merling, it's a relaxing swim. By the way, Varys' ally, Illyrio, also described as a big fat man who wears robes that cover his lower half. Do we have a Merling conspiracy at work? If so, who could be other co-conspirators? What about our fan favorite, Lord Manderly of White Harbor? Oh, don't worry about him. He's fully human. A fully human, hugely fat man with a taste for human flesh, who has a Merling for his family sigil. Yeah, nothing to see there. Let's just move along. Back to Varys, you'll recall his verbal sparring with Tyrion in A Clash of Kings, also featured on a television series in Season 2. Remember this little exchange?
"When they were done, Varys came gliding into the hall, wearing flowing lavender robes that matched his smell. Oh, sweetly done, my good lord. Then why do I have this bitter taste in my mouth?" He pressed his fingers into his temples. "I told them to throw Aladim into the sea. I am sorely tempted to do the same with you." "You make me disappointed by the result," Varys replied. "The storms come and go, the waves crash overhead, the big fish eat the little fish, and I keep on paddling."
Sure, I bet Tyrion would be real disappointed when Varys transforms into a human jet ski as soon as he touches water and motors off to summon his Merling army to destroy King's Landing. Let's talk about Varys' main antagonist, Littlefinger. He claims to have some sort of hold over Varys.
Littlefinger smiled. "Leave Lord Varys to me, sweet lady. If you will permit me a small obscenity, and where better for it than here, I hold a man's balls in the palm of my hand." He cupped his finger, smiling. "Or would, if he were a man, or had any balls, you say. If the pie is opened, the birds begin to sing, and Varys would not like that."
What could Littlefinger possibly have over Varys? Perhaps his secret identity as a Merling? After all, Littlefinger's vessel is called the Merling King. A subtle tweak at his rival? Or is he just flaunting his power over Varys the Merling? Ask yourself, what is Varys endgame, though? Doesn't really make sense in the book. He's, you know, doing some things to subvert King's Landing, and he's working with Illyrio to put a Targaryen back on the throne. It's all very nebulous, and we're not really sure exactly where it's going. But it's indisputable that he and Illyrio have supplied Dany with dragon eggs, putting themselves firmly on the side of fire against the coming winter. This is the song of ice and fire. What do you get when you combine ice and fire? You get water. Imagine an army of dragons bringing about an endless summer that melts the ice wall and all the frozen wastelands of the lands of always winter, simultaneously flooding most of Westeros, providing Lebenstrom for the Merling race, elbow room for their race's expansion, and a bounty of dead humans for the Merlings to feast upon. Once the sea level rises, very few places will be habitable by men. Only a few high places, such as the Eyrie, where Littlefinger now rules. Littlefinger, the Merling King. So there you have it. If you've not been educated or stimulated, I hope at least you were entertained. We'll be back next week for another action-packed spoiler edition where we'll consider a bunch of new listener emails, and I'll try to cobble together some tinfoil. But in the meantime, join us Sunday night for our Instant Take podcast, where we cover episode 508, Hard Home, and of course, on Tuesday when we release the full schedule. If you've enjoyed the spoiler section, please take some time to go to club.baldmove.com and see how you can support us. Or if you shop on Amazon, visit amazon.baldmove.com for all your Amazon shopping needs. Because the God's honest truth is, you wouldn't have three Game of Thrones podcasts if Jim and I weren't able to do this stuff on a full-time basis. And we're blessed by fan support that allows us to do that and cover your favorite shows and cover them to the depth and extent that you've grown accustomed to and enjoy. So please do your part to help us help you by supporting us at club.baldmove.com or using amazon.baldmove.com. Thanks to everyone listening. Thanks to everyone writing in for giving us fuel for the fire. And we'll see you next week. Have a great weekend.